Under each name, they print Primary Aim. For the next hour or so, Jack and Murray each visualizes how he would like to have his life look and writes his conclusions on the page in front of him. Then they spend another hour or so talking about what they wrote, sharing their personal dreams with each other, perhaps discovering in that hour more about each other than they had known in all their years as brothers. The next step Jack and Murray take is to draw a line across a blank piece of paper about a third of the way down. Above the line, they write in bold letters the word shareholders. They have agreed with each other that is to be their role outside of the business. Inside of the business, they've agreed, they'll from this time forward think of themselves as employees. They realize this will save them a lot of trouble later on. The next step will require some time, the creation of the strategic objective for Widget Makers, Inc. Jack and Murray go at it enthusiastically. Murray agrees to do the necessary research concerning the central demographic model they've tentatively chosen. How many potential buyers are there in the territory in which they've decided to do business? Is the population growing? What is the competition? How are widgets priced and how are they selling? Is there a future for widgets in the territory? What is the anticipated growth of the territory? Any zoning changes expected? Murray also agrees to create a questionnaire and mail it to a sample of their central demographic model consumers to find out how they feel they're treated by other widget companies. At the same time, Murray is to personally call 150 of these consumers. He'll conduct a needs analysis to get a better understanding of how they think and feel about widgets. What do widgets mean to them? How have widgets changed their lives? If they could have any kind of widget at all, what would it look like? How would it feel to use it? What do they want a good widget to do for them? Murray agrees to do the research by a certain date. Meanwhile, Jack agrees to pull together the preliminary financial data needed to secure a loan from the bank, an operating pro forma and a cash flow projection for the first year of operation. Once the information about the consumer, the competition, and the pricing is collected, Jack and Murray will meet again and complete their strategic objective and plug in the final numbers needed for the loan. Luck is with them. The information Murray collects about their central demographic model, the competition, and the pricing is more than encouraging. They complete their strategic objective and then begin the task of organizational development, the creation of their organization chart. Since their strategic objective has indicated how they'll be doing business, one location, assembling and selling widgets, and widget-related accessories to a specific consumer within the territory described as North Marine West, Jack and Murray agree that their organization chart will require the following positions. First, President and Chief Operating Officer, COO, accountable for the overall achievement of the strategic objective and reporting to the shareholders who include, on an equal basis, Jack and Murray. Second, Vice President Marketing, accountable for finding customers and finding new ways to provide customers with the satisfactions they derive from widgets at lower cost and with greater ease and reporting to the COO. Third, Vice President Operations, accountable for keeping customers by delivering to them what is promised by marketing and for discovering new ways of assembling widgets at lower cost and with greater efficiency so as to provide the customer with better service, reporting to the COO. Fourth, Vice President Finance, accountable for supporting both marketing and operations in the fulfillment of their accountabilities by achieving the company's profitability standards and by securing capital whenever it's needed and at the best rates, also reporting to the COO. Fifth, reporting to the vice president marketing are two positions, sales manager and advertising research manager. Sixth, reporting to the vice president operations are three positions, production manager, service manager, and facilities manager. And seventh, reporting to the vice president finance are two positions, accounts receivable manager and accounts payable manager. Jack and Murray sit back and look at the completed organization chart of Widget Makers, Inc. and smile. It sure looks like a big company. The only problem is that Jack and Murray's names will have to fill all the boxes. They're the only two employees. But what they have effectively done is describe all the work that's going to be done in Widget Makers, Inc. when its full potential is realized. More importantly, they have described the work that has to be done right away. Jack and Murray realize that there's no difference between the widget makers of today and the widget makers of tomorrow. The work is the same, only the faces will change. The next job Jack and Murray take on is writing a position contract for each position on their organization chart. A position contract, as we call it at eMyth Worldwide, is a summary of the results to be achieved by each position in the company, the work the occupant of that position is accountable for, a list of standards by which the results are to be evaluated, and a line for the signature of the person who agrees to fulfill those accountabilities. Jack and Murray know that a position contract is not a job description. It is a contract, rather than just a description, between the company and an employee, a summary of the rules of the company's game. It provides each person in an organization with a sense of commitment and accountability. Accountability literally means stand up and be counted. Therefore, the position contract is the document that identifies who's to stand up and what they're being counted on to produce. Having completed the position contracts for the positions within their new company, Jack and Murray, as shareholders, proceed to the most critical task of their new association, naming the people to put in the boxes. And since there are only two of them, it becomes even more critical that they approach this task wisely and carefully if they're to avoid the errors of their past. Once they have that settled, they go below the horizontal line, and in the middle of the piece of paper, they draw a box in which they write the letters COO for Chief Operating Officer or President of their new corporation. The next most difficult step, of course, is to decide which one of them is going to fill that position, understanding that it can only be filled by one of them. There can't be two chief operating officers of a company. Someone has got to be accountable. Someone has got to be in charge. Will it be Jack? Will it be Murray? They ponder the question seriously. This is the person fulfilling the role that will ultimately be accountable to Jack and Murray for the realization of their dream. After careful thought, Murray decides on his own that Jack should do it. Although Murray is the older brother, he knows in his heart that Jack has always taken his accountabilities more seriously. Jack has always been more thorough than Murray. While Murray has always been the more creative of the two, creativity is not necessarily what's called for here. Organization is. After all, their life savings are at stake. If the business is to give them both what they want, someone will have to take it very seriously indeed. Murray confers with Jack about his decision. They both understand what's at stake here. A commitment of trust, both to each other and to the strategic objective they fashioned together with great care. They both understand this is more than just a job. It's a heartfelt commitment. After a long discussion, they agree on Jack for COO, and Jack solemnly accepts the position as well as the authority that goes with it by signing the position contract for COO, or president. Next come the three vice presidential positions, marketing, operations, and finance. Jack asks Murray if he would agree to be vice president marketing, since he did such an exceptional job on the marketing research project at the outset of their venture. Murray agrees enthusiastically. This is the work he had hoped to do all along, and gladly signs the vice president marketing position contract. Jack then signs Murray's position contract as the president, the vice president marketing's manager, on behalf of the company. Next comes Vice President Operations. Jack agrees to take this position because it will be difficult, he reasons with Murray, for Murray to both sell the widgets and make them at the same time. This time, Jack signs the position contract both as Vice President Operations and as President. Finally, Jack takes on the accountability of Vice President Finance and signs the position contract for that position. There's no question between Jack and Murray who's best suited for that job. Murray now assumes the positions of sales manager and advertising research manager and signs those position contracts. Jack takes the positions of production manager, service manager, and facilities manager, as well as those of accounts payable manager and accounts receivable manager, and signs those position contracts. With all position contracts signed, Jack and Murray sit back for a second time to survey what they've done. When they see it, they're shocked. Jack has been given 8 jobs to Murray's 3. Something's got to be changed. After some thought, they agree to have Murray take on the accountabilities of accounts receivable and accounts payable, as well as that of service manager. That makes it 6 jobs each. Anyone should be able to do 6 jobs on an average day, Jack and Murray think to themselves ambitiously. And finally, the organization is done. Not a bit of work has been performed on the job, and yet the two of them were able to conceive of the company, the work that needs to be done, the standards by which they would hold each position accountable, and which position is accountable to which other position, and specifically for what. And upon completing this one preparatory act, a sense of order swept through Jack and Murray, a sense of elation. For despite the obvious size of the job ahead, somehow it looked doable. Somehow, Jack and Murray knew they were going to get it all done. They were organized. They had some semblance of a plan. In creating their organization chart, Jack and Murray had also generated the blueprint for their franchise prototype. Prototyping the position, replacing yourself with a system. Having created a picture of the business as it will look when it's finally done, Jack and Murray start the prototyping process, but at the bottom of the organization, not at the top. They start working on the business where they start working in the business. In the position of salesperson and production person and accounts receivable clerk, not as the owners or partners or shareholders, not as the COO or the vice president of marketing, but as employees at the very bottom of the organization doing tactical work, not strategic work. Tactical work is the work all technicians do. Strategic work is the work their managers do. If Jack and Murray's business is going to thrive, they have to find other people to do the tactical work so as to free Jack and Murray to do the strategic work. The organization chart is the means through which that critical transition can be made. Let's watch as Jack and Murray go through the same growth process they experienced at the beginning of this chapter, but this time avoiding their earlier disaster by prototyping the positions in their organization chart. Jack and Murray go to work in their business, but now with a difference. They're no longer interested in working in their business. They are now focused on developing a business that works. To do that, they begin to work in an entirely different way. As Murray goes to work in the position of salesperson, he also goes to work on the position of salesperson as vice president marketing. As Jack goes to work in the position of production person, he also goes to work on the position of production person as vice president operations. In other words, Murray and Jack start building their business by looking at each position in the business as though it were a franchise prototype of its own. As Murray goes to work in the position of salesperson as a salesperson, he also goes to work on the position of salesperson by implementing the business development process of innovation, quantification, and orchestration. Likewise, when Jack goes to work in the position of production person as a production person, he goes to work on the position of production person by implementing the business development process of innovation, quantification, and orchestration. Each of them asks, what would best serve our customers here? How could I most easily give the customer what he wants while also maximizing profits for the company? And at the same time, how could I give the person responsible for that work the best possible experience? Murray begins to test the clothing he wears as a salesperson to see what colors and styles produce the greatest positive impact on the customers. He starts testing different words. He begins to think about how Widget Makers, Inc. interacts with its customers and how each component of this interaction could be modified to increase its effectiveness. And as he quantifies the impact of his innovations on sales, he takes the most productive of them and writes them down in the Widget Makers Sales Operations Manual. Before long, the Sales Operations Manual contains the exact scripts for handling incoming calls, outgoing calls, meeting the customer at the door, the exact responses to customer inquiries, complaints, concerns, the system by which an order is entered, returns are transacted, new product requests are acted upon, inventory is secured. And only when the sales operations manual is complete does Murray run an ad for a salesperson. But not for somebody with sales experience. Not a master technician, but a novice, a beginner, an apprentice. Someone eager to learn how to do it right. Someone willing to learn what Murray has spent so much time and energy discovering. Someone for whom questions haven't become answers. Someone who is open to the possibility of learning skills he hasn't developed yet, skills he wants to learn. And the ad is placed under sales in the classified section of the Sunday paper. It reads, come and see our turnkey operation. Come and see our money machine. No experience necessary, just an open mind and a willingness to learn. And as Murray interviews the candidates, he shows them the sales operations manual and Widget Maker's strategic objective and explains how they were created and why. He tells them the story of Widget Makers, the dream he and Jack conceived to enable them to make a personal difference in the market in which they have chosen to become leaders. He shows them the organization chart, where the position of salesperson is, to which position it reports, and who in Widget Makers is currently accountable for that position. He talks to them about their primary aim, to determine who among them has a vision that coincides with Widget Maker's view of the world. And when he finds the right person, Murray hires him, hands him the sales operations manual, has him memorize the words in it, dress to code, learn the systems, and finally go to work, using the sales system Murray innovated, quantified, and orchestrated. At that moment, at that exact moment, Murray moves up to the position of sales manager and begins the process of business development all over again. Because at that moment, Murray has taken the most important step in freeing himself from the tactical work of his business. Murray has replaced himself with a system that works in the hands of a person who wants to work it. And now Murray's job becomes managing the system rather than doing the work. Murray is now engaged in strategic work. And while Murray did that, Jack did the very same thing for each of the tactical work positions he was responsible for. Both of them working on the business while working in it, and all according to plan. Now Jack and Murray have learned by experience an important lesson in developing their business, a lesson every technician suffering from an entrepreneurial seizure must learn if his business and his life are to work in harmony. That your organization chart flows down from your strategic objective, which in turn flows down from your primary aim. That each is the cause of the one preceding it, and each, therefore, plays a part in the fulfillment of the one before it. A logic is established, an integrated whole. In this example, Widget Makers, Inc. became an orderly system for creating and recreating Jack and Murray's lives. Without the organization chart, confusion, discord, and conflict become the order of the day. But with it, the direction, purpose, and style of the business are balanced, interacting purposefully and progressing with intention and integrity toward a cohesive and sensible whole. Finally, good people could come together and get something done. Sarah exhaled loudly and stretched, both arms extending fully toward the ceiling as though she was letting go of a feeling she was having difficulty handling. "Boy," she said, "you sure don't make it easy. The minute I think I've got this entrepreneurial thing handled, you give me some more work to do. I'd like to go back over this again because I'm not sure I've got it." "What you're saying," she continued, "is that I need to create an organization chart for All About Pies as it will look when it's done 7 years from now rather than the way it is now?" "Yes," I responded. She continued with her question. "And that once I've created that organization chart, I need to put my name in all the positions I currently fill?" "Right again," I answered. She went on. "And that I need to create very detailed descriptions of each and every one of those positions, and then sign the position contracts for each as though I were an employee taking responsibility for each job? Do you mean I actually need to sign each position contract exactly as though I were that employee?" "Yes," I said, "exactly as though you were that employee. Because if your business is going to work, you are each one of those employees. Until you replace yourself with someone else, that is." Sarah continued to press forward, her eyes shining like diamonds, intense, awake, engaged. "And the reason for that is," Sarah said, "that unless I act as I expect my employees to act, unless I work in my business exactly as I wish them to, I will never be able to create a system for doing it exactly the way I expect them to do it, In other words, unless I act in exactly the same way as I expect my employees to act, the system I create will indulge my preferences rather than what the business really needs to make it possible for everyone other than me to be as productive and happy as possible. And if I only indulge my preferences, I will never be able to replace myself with anyone other than another owner. Someone just like me. Someone with the same interests as an owner. Someone with the same goals as mine. She paused for a moment as though to catch her breath, and then she added, "Is that what you're saying?" "Exactly," I answered. "Because it's critical, if you're to begin your business all over again, that you're able to separate yourself from the roles you need to play, to become independent of them, rather than these roles becoming dependent on you. Remember, we talked earlier about the crazy-making nature of all your different personalities, and that the only way to eliminate that craziness is to organize yourself and the world around you as clearly as possible, so you can function as clearly as possible? Well, it's the dysfunctional nature of these unconscious personalities we have to combat. It's our automatic nature we have got to organize into an intentional nature. And the only way we can do that is intentionally, not automatically. And so one part of us, the part a man named Gurdjieff once called the driver, must order all the rest. The driver must take charge of the horse and carriage, Gurdjieff once said. And as the owner of your business, as the driver of your business, that's your primary job, to take charge of the horse and the carriage. And to do so, you must be able to differentiate among all the roles, to discriminate between what's most important and what's least important, to organize it in such a way that your best intelligence tells you your business must work. And once you have done that, once you've organized your business in the most intelligent way you can, your next most important job is to follow the rules of the game you've created with integrity. Because if you won't follow the rules, why should anyone else? If the rules don't apply to you, the leader, why should you expect anyone to follow you? If you don't obey the rules, honor them, extol them, why should you expect anyone else to take your game seriously? The answer is, you can't expect them to, because they won't. And that's what this whole process of organizational development is. It's the process through which you think through your business as best as you're able, and then structure the way it is to work. Your organization chart is that structure. It is you talking to your people in the world, telling them exactly how you see your business working when it's done, when the dream is in place. It's you sharing your mind with the world. And then, once having shared it, it's you telling your people and the world that you believe enough in the vision to live it yourself. Anything less than that is sheer arrogance, I told her. But when you live by your own rules, when you walk your talk, when you live as you think, then your business will become a thing to behold. Got it, Sarah said. I didn't have a doubt in the world, but you would, I responded. So let's go on to management development, I said to Sarah as I poured her a fresh cup of tea, and then to people development. Because where management, people, and systems come together, so does your prototype. Chapter 15, Your Management Strategy. The system is the solution. AT&T. You may think that the successful implementation of a management strategy is dependent on finding amazingly competent managers, people with finely honed people skills, with degrees from management schools, with highly sophisticated techniques for dealing with and developing their people. It isn't. You don't need such people, nor can you afford them. In fact, they will be the bane of your existence. What you need instead is a management system. The system will become your management strategy, the means through which your franchise prototype produces the results you want. The system will become your solution to the problems that beset you because of the unpredictability of your people. The system will transform your people problems into an opportunity by orchestrating the process by which management decisions are made, while eliminating the need for such decisions wherever and whenever possible. What is a management system? It is a system designed into your prototype to produce a marketing result. And the more automatic that system is, the more effective your franchise prototype will be. Management development, the process through which you create your management system and teach your up-and-coming managers to use it, isn't a management tool as many people believe. It's a marketing tool. Its purpose is not just to create an efficient prototype, but an effective one. And an effective prototype is a business that finds and keeps customers profitably better than any other. Let's look at how such a system was put into practice by a resort hotel I've patronized over the past 17 years. A match, a mint, a cup of coffee, and a newspaper. The first time it was an accident. That is, an accident for me. I hadn't planned to go there. I'd been driving for 7 hours, and tired of the road, decided to stop for the night before going on to San Francisco. The hotel was located in a redwood grove overlooking the Pacific Ocean. By the time I walked into the lobby, the sun was setting and the grove had turned dark as pitch. Instantly, something told me that I was in a special place. The lobby was warmly lighted. Redwood paneling reflected the red glow of the light onto beige, overstuffed couches that hugged the three walls surrounding the reception desk. A long, dark wood table faced the front door through which I had just entered. On the table rested a huge woven Indian basket overflowing with fresh fruit. Beside the basket stood a massive bronze lamp, its deep burnished light bouncing off the fruit and adding a festive look to the room. Running the full length of the table and falling down on either end almost to the floor was an intricately crocheted linen cloth, its bright exotic pattern accentuating the colors of the fruit, the bronze of the lamp, and the deep red ochre of the walls. At the far side of the table, against the far wall, in a massive fieldstone fireplace, a roaring fire filled the room with the cheerful crackling of its furiously burning oak logs. If I hadn't been so tired, the contrast between the heat of the flames on my face and the cold of the night at my back would have been enough to attract me to the room. As it was, I practically melted with delight. Behind the reception desk, a woman appeared dressed in a freshly starched red, green, and white gingham blouse and a deep red ochre skirt. A pin with the logo of the hotel atop a red ochre ribbon decorated her blouse like a badge of honor. A matching ribbon held her hair back from a glowing face. "Welcome to Venetia," she smiled warmly. It took me no more than 3 minutes from the moment she spoke that greeting to the time the bellboy ushered me into my room, despite the fact that I had no reservation. I couldn't believe the ease with which it all happened. And the room. The overall impression was one of understated opulence. Thick, muted pastel, wall-to-wall carpeting, a four-poster king-size white pine bed covered by a magnificent, impeccably clean, white-on-white quilt. Original graphics depicting scenes and birds of the Pacific Northwest gracing the rough-hewn elegance of the natural cedar walls. A stone fireplace with oak logs already prepared and waiting on the grate. For the fire someone knew I would appreciate, paper rolled ceremoniously beneath the grate, and an elegant, oversized match lying diagonally across the hearth, waiting to be struck. Delighted with my good fortune, I changed for dinner. The woman at the desk had made my reservation when she checked me in. I walked out into the night to find the restaurant. A sign by a path outside my room pointed me down another well-lit path through the dark redwood grove. The night air was still and clear. In the distance, I could hear the hushed, rhythmic patter of the Pacific Ocean surf. Or was it my imagination? It scarcely mattered. An aura of magic surrounded the place. The restaurant stood in a knoll overlooking the hotel and the ocean. Until I went inside, I hadn't seen another person, but the restaurant was crowded. I gave the maitre d' my name, and he immediately showed me to a table, despite the fact that other people were waiting. Evidently, reservations meant something in this restaurant. The meal was as delightful as everything I had experienced before it. The food, attractively prepared. The service, attentive, yet unobtrusive. I lingered over a glass of brandy while enjoying a classical guitarist who played a selection of Bach fugues for the dinner guests. I signed the check and returned to my room, noting on the way that the lights had been turned up on the path, apparently to compensate for the growing darkness. By the time I arrived at my room, the night had become chilly. I was looking forward to a fire and possibly another brandy before going to bed. Somebody had beaten me to it. A brisk fire was already burning in the fireplace. The quilt was turned down on the bed. The pillows were plumped up, a mint resting on each one. On one of the night tables beside the bed stood a glass of brandy and a card. I picked up the card and read, "Welcome to your first stay at Venetia. I hope it has been enjoyable. If there is anything I can do for you, day or night, please don't hesitate to call. Kathy." As I drifted to sleep that evening, I felt very well taken care of. The following morning, I awoke to a strange bubbling sound in the bathroom. I arose to investigate. A pot of coffee, turned on by an automatic timer, was merrily perking away on the sink counter. A card resting against the pot said, "Your brand of coffee. Enjoy. K." And it was my brand of coffee. How in the world could they have known that? And then I remembered, at the restaurant the night before, they had asked me what brand of coffee I preferred. And here it was. Just as I caught on to what they had done, there was a polite knock at the door. I went to the door and opened it. Nobody. But there on the mat was a newspaper. My newspaper. The New York Times. How in the world did they know that? And then I remembered. When I checked in the night before, the receptionist had asked me what newspaper I preferred. I hadn't given it another thought. Until now. And there it was. And exactly the same scenario has occurred each and every time I've returned. But after that first time, I was never asked my preferences again. I'd become part of the hotel's management system, and never once has it let me down. The system knows what I like and makes certain that I get it in exactly the same way, at exactly the same time. What exactly had the system provided? a match, a mint, a cup of coffee, and a newspaper. But it wasn't the match, the mint, the cup of coffee, or the newspaper that did it. It was that somebody had heard me. And they heard me every single time. The moment I walked into the room and felt the fire, I knew that someone had thought about me, had thought about what I wanted. I hadn't said a word, and yet they had heard me. The moment I saw the mints on the pillows, the turned-down quilt, and the brandy on the table, I knew that someone had thought about me, had thought about what I wanted. I hadn't said a word, and yet they had heard me. The moment I heard the coffee pot perking in the bathroom and saw the card that identified it as my brand, I remembered that someone had asked for my preference, and they had heard my answer. The instant I saw the newspaper and recognized it as my newspaper, I remembered that someone had asked, and they had heard my answer, and it was totally automatic. Every single element was an orchestrated solution designed to produce a marketing result, an integrated component of the hotel's management system. After my third visit to the hotel, I asked to speak with the manager. I wanted to find out how he was able to produce the identical results for me every single time. How could he make certain that someone would ask the right question so as to ensure the correct results for each and every guest? Was it because he hired extremely competent people? Were the employees owners? Was it some kind of special incentive system? The manager was a young man of 29. He invited me into his office to talk. It was well lit, modest in size, and overlooked the redwood grove I had walked through to get to the restaurant. His desk was clean and neatly organized, not a loose paper in sight. This is a very orderly young man, I thought to myself. Perhaps he's the reason the hotel works so well. The young manager obviously enjoyed his job because he warmed immediately to the conversation about his work and the task of producing the results for which he was held accountable by the hotel's owner. "You know," he said, smiling self-consciously, "it's funny sitting here talking to you about what we do here at the hotel. Because until 5 months ago, the only experience I had in the hotel business was as a guest for two nights at a Holiday Inn in Fresno 3 years ago. In fact," he continued, "before this job, I was working as a short-order cook at a restaurant nearby. The owner and I got to know each other. He asked if I'd like to learn the hotel business, and before I knew it, he hired me. Everything I know about the hotel business, I've learned here. Here, let me show you." He reached behind his desk for a red binder. Printed on the spine were the initials OM and the logo of the hotel. "What we do here is simple. Anyone can do it." He opened the binder to the table of contents. "This is our operations manual. As you can see, it's nothing but a series of checklists. This one is a checklist for setting up a room." He opened the book to a yellow page. "This group of pages is yellow. Everything in the manual is color-coded. Yellow has to do with room setup, blue with guest support services. For instance, when we light your fire at night, put the mints on your pillow, and so on. Each checklist itemizes the specific steps each room support person must take to do his or her job. There are 8 packages of checklists for each room support person waiting in their mailbox when they come in every day. Each package of checklists is used for one of the 8 rooms the room support person is accountable for. As a room support person goes about the process of taking care of his or her 8 rooms, a checklist is completed to confirm that each accountability was performed according to the standards. As you can see, here at the bottom of the checklist is a place for the RSP to sign. indicating that he or she did the prescribed work. To sign and not to have done the work is grounds for instant dismissal. But there's another part of the system that really makes it work. On the back of each checklist is a drawing of the specific room that identifies each task to be completed and the order in which it has to be done. The drawing takes the RSP through the routine, and as they complete each task, they check off the corresponding part of the drawing to show that it was done. With this drawing, we can train new people almost instantly and have them producing a result identical to that of a person who's been with us for quite some time. As added insurance, my RSP supervisors run spot checks every day to make certain that any errors are caught in time. He paused and smiled. But there are rarely any errors. The system works like a charm. There's an equally effective system for everything we do here. The fact is, the owner worked it all out in advance. The lighting, the sauna, and the pool are timed electronically and synchronized with the seasons so that they deliver a predictable result to the guests. For example, you might have noticed that at night the outdoor lights increase in intensity as it gets darker. That's done automatically. No one has to think about it. I could give you lots of other examples, but I think you get the point. The whole thing was put together in a way the owner believed would make a positive impression on our guests. You'd be amazed at how many people come up to me after staying here just to thank me for how well they were treated. But it's not the big things they talk about. It's always the little things. I could understand and believe all he had said, but still I asked, "How do you get your RSPs to use the checklists? How do you get them to use the system? Don't they get tired of the routine? Doesn't it get boring for them?" "Ah," said my willing host, "that's where we really shine." Chapter 16, Your People Strategy. Life games reflect life aims. Robert S. DeRopp, The Master Game. How do I get my people to do what I want? This is the one question I hear most often from small business owners. And the answer I invariably give them is, you can't. You can't get your people to do anything. If you want it done, I tell them, you're going to have to create an environment in which doing it is more important to your people than not doing it. Where doing it well becomes a way of life for them. Since that's the question most often asked of me, I was intrigued with the hotel manager's answer to my question, how do you get your people to do what you want? His response was refreshing, because it is so rare that I hear something like it. The first thing that surprised me when I came to work here, the manager said, was that the owner took me seriously. I mean, think about it. Here I was, a kid, with absolutely no experience in this business. But he never treated me that way. He treated me as though I were a serious adult, somebody worth talking to about what he obviously considered important. And that was the second thing that surprised me when I came to work here, the manager continued. How seriously the boss took the operation of this hotel. I mean, it just wasn't that he took it seriously. Everyone I've ever worked for was serious about his business. It was the kind of seriousness he had. It was as though the hotel was more than just a hotel to him. It was like the hotel was an expression of who he was, a symbol of what he believed in. So if I hadn't taken the hotel seriously, it would have looked like I wasn't taking him seriously, as a man whose values I respected. I guess that's why he took me seriously. It established a level of communication between us that made it possible for me to listen to what he believed in and how the hotel expressed those beliefs on a day-to-day basis. "I'll never forget my first day here," he went on. "It was like I was being initiated into a fraternity or something. It was right here that it happened." He waved his arm in a circle, indicating the office in which we were sitting. "This used to be his office." "I was sitting where you're sitting," he said, "and the boss was sitting here." He pointed at the chair in which he was sitting. It was a Monday morning, and they had just had a big weekend, so there was a ton of stuff to do. Usually when I start a new job, the first thing that happens is that the person who hires me takes a minute to describe what I'm supposed to do and then throws me out there to do it. So I was surprised when the boss asked me if I wanted a cup of coffee. He seemed so unhurried, so unbusinesslike, you might say. No, that wasn't it, the manager corrected himself. He was probably the most businesslike person I had ever met. But it was how he was about his business that struck me. He seemed to be saying that what we were going to talk about was the most important thing on his agenda that day, that discussing my job was more important to him than doing the work that was going on at the time. He wasn't hiring me to work. He was hiring me to do something much more important than that. The manager smiled. "You know, I've never said this to anyone before. It's really strange. But while I'm telling you all of this, it's becoming clear to me why I have so much respect for this place. It's because I have so much respect for the boss. To me, the place is him. If I didn't respect him, I don't think I would be as good at what I do here as I am. Somehow, the idea of what we do here is his idea. And that's what he took so long to communicate to me on that very first day. His idea of this place and what that meant to him. What he told me was something nobody has ever said to me before in any job. He said, the work we do is a reflection of who we are. If we're sloppy at it, it's because we're sloppy inside. If we're late at it, it's because we're late inside. If we're bored by it, it's because we're bored inside, with ourselves, not with the work. The most menial work can be a piece of art when done by an artist. So the job here is not outside of ourselves, but inside of ourselves. How we do our work becomes a mirror of how we are inside. The manager continued, as if the owner were talking through him. Work is passive without you. It can't do anything. Work is only an idea before a person does it. But the moment a person does it, the impact of the work on the world becomes a reflection of that idea, the idea behind the work, as well as the person doing it. In the process, the work you do becomes you, and you become the force that breathes life into the idea behind the work. You become the creator of the impact on the world of the work you do. There is no such thing as undesirable work, he continued. There are only people who see certain kinds of work as undesirable. People who use every excuse in the world to justify why they have to do work they hate to do. People who look upon their work as a punishment for who they are and where they stand in the world, rather than as an opportunity to see themselves as they really are. What the boss said is that people like that don't bring life to the idea of the work they do. They bring death to it. The result of that is always what we experience as the sloppy, inconsiderate, inconsistent, and inhuman transactions that take place between most businesses and the people who buy from them. exactly the opposite of what we have here. And the reason it's different here is because we give everyone who comes to work at the hotel an opportunity to make a choice. Not after they've done the work, but before. And we do that by making sure they understand the idea behind the work they're being asked to do. "I guess that's what excited me most about taking this job," said the manager. "It's the very first place I've ever gone to work where there was an idea behind the work that was more important than the work itself." The idea the boss expressed to me was broken down into three parts. The first says that the customer is not always right, but whether he is or not, it is our job to make him feel that way. The second says that everyone who works here is expected to work toward being the best he can possibly be at the tasks he's accountable for. When he can't do that, he should act like he is until he gets around to it. And if he's unwilling to act like it, he should leave. The third says that the business is a place where everything we know how to do is tested by what we don't know how to do, and that the conflict between the two is what creates growth, is what creates meaning. The idea the boss has about the business comes down to one essential notion, that a business is like a martial arts practice hall, a dojo, a place you go to practice being the best you can be. But the true combat in a dojo is not between one person and another, as most people believe it to be. The true combat in a martial arts practice hall is between the people within ourselves. That's what the boss and I talked about in our first meeting. His philosophy about work and about business. I came to understand that the hotel was the least important thing in our relationship. What was important was how seriously I took to playing the game he had created here. He wasn't looking for employees so much as for players in his game. He was looking for people who wanted something more than just a job. What the manager was telling me and what the boss had told him was that people, your people, do not simply want to work for exciting people. They want to work for people who have created a clearly defined structure for acting in the world, a structure through which they can test themselves and be tested. Such a structure is called a game. And there is nothing more exciting than a well-conceived game. That is what the very best businesses represent to the people who create them. A game to be played in which the rules symbolize the idea you, the owner, have about the world. If your idea is a positive one, your business will reflect that optimism. If your idea is a negative one, your business will reflect that as well. In this context, the degree to which your people do what you want is the degree to which they buy into your game. And the degree to which they buy into your game doesn't depend on them, but on how well you communicate the game to them. At the outset of your relationship, not after it's begun. Your people's strategy is the way you communicate this idea. It starts with your primary aim and your strategic objective, and continues through your organizational strategy, your organization chart, and the position contracts for all the positions in it, and the operations manuals that define the work your people do. It is communicated through the beliefs you have and the way you expect your prototype to exemplify them, through the standards you establish for the performance of accountabilities at all levels and in all sectors of your prototype, through the words you use to describe what your business needs to become for your customer, for your people, for yourself, if it's to be more than just a place where people go to work. But the game your business will play can't simply be captured on the written page. It must be seen if it's to work. It must be experienced. It is first, last, and always about how you act. The words will become hollow if the game is a contrived one. The game can't be created as a device to enroll your people. It can't become cynical if it's to provide your people with what they need.